Welcome back to Everything is a Primary Source, the podcast version of Quantum Leap, going from year to year in history to get a first-person perspective of each era. But instead of leaping into people, like Dr. Sam Beckett, we drop in on pop culture, like movies, TV shows, books, toys, games, and music, to learn about the past. Also, I don't have a holograph of a womanizer to guide me around, and as far as I know, these podcasts don't actually alter the course of history. Other than those minor details, that is the podcast in a nutshell. Today's episode is about California, and more specifically what California has long represented in American society and culture. I made my very first visit to the Golden State this past summer and loved every minute of it. As a born and bred Easterner, I've always seen California as a promise of sorts, the promise of a fresh start, a multitude of opportunities that simply don't exist anywhere else, and the promise of perfect weather all year round. Surf guitarist Laramie Dean joins me today to talk about his friend and mentor Dick Dale, who 60 years ago released two albums, one of which dubbed him King of the Surf Guitar, and the other, what we're going to dissect, the follow-up, Checkered Flag, which was released in the fall of that same year, 1963. But first, here's my interview with Janice of the SCA. I met up with the California native virtually this past June, while she was attending the Society for Commercial Archaeology's annual conference, a group with which she has long been active. We had a great conversation, which for me resulted in a clearer picture of Southern California's rich history.
It's interesting because I was talking to a friend one day and I said, I had this really, you know, bizarre love of roadside architecture and old diners and neon signs. And I thought I was, you know, weird and alone in that. And she said, oh, I actually belong to an organization that this is exactly what we do. And so I immediately, you know, joined. And then within a year, I was a board member. And so I've been very involved in the organization ever since.
And you're definitely not alone in that. Those things are just incredible. And I got to say, you live in the perfect part of the country for a lot of those kinds of features. And do you think that's what contributed to your interest in it?
Definitely. I'm someone who is naturally interested in history and ruins. So, you know, a lot of mine goes back all the way to Roman ruins and things like that. But yeah. One of the things that happened when I was in high school was that one of my favorite movie theaters, our local movie theater, Manhattan Beach, the Lamar, it was, you know, a classic single theater. It was closed and then turned into the headquarters for Skechers. And, you know, it was really sad. We actually put the Lamar on my senior high school yearbook, on the cover of it because, you know, everyone was just sort of tragically affected by the closing and the raising of the Lamar. And, you know, I thought, well, that's, you know, so sad that, you know, without in a blink of an eye, you know, this beloved theater that we had could be gone. And so, you know, that I think that was one of the first instances where it affected me personally. And, you know, and so it really piqued my interest in, you know, this idea of preservation and appreciation for these things.
Do you feel that in Southern California, because everything is newer? I mean, there's not a lot of, you know, a lot of things there are 20th century. Do you feel that overall the culture there might not appreciate the history, even if it doesn't date back 200 years? They might not appreciate history along the same lines that you do.
It's interesting. Actually, the oldest preservation group in the country is the LA Conservancy. So actually the very first preservation group is from LA. And they've done a fabulous job of preserving a lot of the historic downtown LA buildings. And so, despite the fact that it's you know, it doesn't have the history that the East Coast does as far as the length of history. There's a huge appreciation for it. And, you know, there is, you know, there are groups that, you know, when a neon sign is on a business and the business has gone out of business, you know, there's, you know, there are groups who are local groups, you know, who are saying we want to preserve the sign, even though it's for a different business. You know, we still want to preserve the sign either, you know, there at the business or somehow. So there's still a lot of that. And one of the things is, you know, someone who's lived in Southern California and in California, including the coastal California, that's why I know so much about Vina Robles and places and Solvang, is that, you know, it's, we've seen an evolution from a very Western culture, you know, where, you know, I mean, you'll see this when you travel there, but, you know, you'll see there's boot barns and there's, you know, places for saddles and things like that, because there's still, especially on the Central Coast where you'll be visiting, there's, it's still very Western there, you know, relatively Western. It's become more, you know, more of a viniculture as it's moved more toward, you know, grape growing and winemaking. But there's still a lot of a Western aspect to it. So a lot of what I, you know, loved, appreciated were things that, like, for years I've driving up and down US 101, you know, which is the north-south main artery in California. And one of the things that struck me in you know, the 90s and 2000s was this place called the Wagon Wheel, you know, where it had this incredibly classic, you know, huge wagon wheel, right in Oxnard, right at 101. And I was like, how can this place still be here? And sure enough, you know, not shortly after that, you know, I saw, you know, because it was among all these, you know, huge box stores, you know, the usual gigantic box stores. And then, you know, you have this little remnant of the Western culture. And so, you know, it unfortunately was ultimately demolished. But, you know, it's those types of things that, you know, are still, you know, I hope we can hang on to, you know, as many of those as possible. And I heard that a local bar has now done a little homage to the wagon wheel, which is nice.
That is good. And maybe I should modify my statement and question earlier, you know, just asking about if people don't really pay as much, because that actually might be more of an East Coast thing, because, you know, we have a longer Anglo history than, you know, so it's almost like when people became aware of history going away, people in the Western part of the country, which is newer, might have that much more of a ownership of it and a care for it. Whereas when I'm driving around and I see a little cemetery here in New Hampshire, like a family cemetery that's surrounded on one side by a gas station, the other side by a Taco Bell, that tells me actually maybe people don't care as much around here as they might out there.
It's interesting because, you know, as we're talking about this, one of the things I was thinking about is, you know, there's the evolution of, you know, you can have preservation when you have education, when you have money, when you've, you know, when you've met certain elements within your culture, right? And one of the interesting things about the West Coast is that, you know, we've reached that, you know, universally across the United States. But the West Coast has reached that earlier with respect to the age of our buildings, because, you know, and so we've had this ability to catch things earlier on than, you know, than the East Coast, some of these places where, you know, the buildings have existed for longer. So, you know, as we're talking about that, you know, I think that's a fascinating thing, is that we've actually been able to save things earlier because we've reached that state in our, you know, our countrywide culture, in our countrywide socioeconomic situation status.
Yeah. I mean, I guess that's where I was going with it, was because when you look at, you know, even just like a political map of the United States reveals that, you know, because the abilities of travel in the times that the Eastern states were being formed, you know, into colonies and everything, you know, was limited. By the time the West starts to be populated, you had railroads and eventually automobiles. So the states are gigantic, because to travel from any section of that state to the capital wouldn't nearly take as long because of modern transportation. So I'm sure that's reflected, like you said, also in just kind of the speed of awareness. There's a great essay that I'm a teacher, and I share with my students an essay called Born Modern, How the West Came to Be by Richard White. And, you know, he's out of Stanford. So he, and that's his focal point is Western United States history. And his thesis basically is that the modern West, you know, the West as we know it, is a product of the Civil War and World War II. And that it's basically the federal government, you know, the Eastern part of the country didn't have the federal government to develop it. You know, but a lot of 13 of the states predate the federal government, whereas much of the West had the guidance of, I think a good part of Nevada is still owned by yes. Washington, basically. So right. They had the guidance of and sort of the influence of federal power, which grew so much after the Civil War and during the Civil War and grew so much even more during the 30s and into World War II. So what you're seeing, he also, I saw him on another clip one time, referring to the West as being far more urban than rural, than most people think of the West as, like you said, you know, cowboys and, you know, wide open spaces. That doesn't mean those spaces are actually occupied, you know, like in order to be rural, you really have to have somebody living there and using the land for, you know, something. Otherwise it's just barren. I did travel. A few summers ago, we took a drive from New Hampshire all the way to the Grand Canyon. And I was really tempted because I'd never been to California before. I saw the sign in Flagstaff. It said Los Angeles, 400 some odd miles away. I'm like, that's one more day. We didn't end up doing it. We turned it back after the Grand Canyon. But I recognized that right away when I was out there. Like as soon as we passed, I would say maybe even as early as the Mississippi River. Definitely after we got past Oklahoma, I was recognizing, I'm like, yeah, that's pretty right. Like you can go, you know, in New Mexico and Arizona, dozens of miles, if not more, without seeing anything. And then you're in a city. Mm-hmm. And then you go, you know, another 100 miles and then there's another city. Whereas in the East, it's all just one patchwork of towns and villages that you meander through as you go along. So, okay, great. Because since you are from Southern California, a few years ago, and I just rediscovered it in my stack of stuff in my classroom the other day, I found a scrapbook from a 1939 trip to California that two women made from Haverhill, Massachusetts. And it has everything from their itinerary, their train tickets. They even have some menus from restaurants in San Francisco and LA. I don't know why I overlooked it a few years ago. I just kind of like, is there a bunch of sheet music or something? But I've been looking, they even have a copy of, the observatory in LA's, like magazine,
Griffith
the,
Park.
You know, uh-huh. The Observer was the name. Yeah, it's called the Griffith Observer, and there's a uh-huh. a complete volume of that in the this collection of primary sources. And I'm like, this is so cool, not only because it's from 1939 and it already kind of smashes some of our perceptions of that era of everybody was suffering from the Depression, nobody had any money at all, because these women went on like a month-long trip across the country, you know, to and spend all this time and I assume money over there. But also it really is meaningful to me because I'm like, I'm planning basically the same trip. You know, cool. I'm going to be taking airplanes this time, but I'm like the timing of discovering this and some of the things that, you know, they still has a ticket book from the parlor car that they took from San Francisco through Yosemite all the way down to LA. So, you know, maybe, at the very least, you can read the essay, and if maybe I'll we'll be in touch when I come to California, and you can show me around a little bit.
I would be more than happy to. And while I'm thinking of it, I just recently got half season tickets to the Dodgers. And there's a place in Echo Park right near Dodger Stadium. It's called Frenchie's. And supposedly it is the place where French dip sandwiches were invented around the very early 1900s. And the place is still in business and it's still hugely popular. It just has an incredibly long line. So
we'll have to check that out. My wife is a big French dip fan. So, oh,
perfect. Yeah. So, excellent. Excellent.
I love these connections that I make. Whenever I do podcast karaoke, and this is the first one I've ever done virtually, but whenever I do this where people come to me and I talk, I learn so many incredible stories. And you are definitely on that list of really interesting people that I'm so glad I got to talk to.
And likewise, and yeah, I'm very happy to give you any advice you'd like and host you around it when you come out here.
It was really great getting the street-level view of Southern California from someone who calls it home, and I did end up contacting Janice for some sightseeing tips after we arrived in L.A. this summer. It felt really cool, by the way, to keep saying, "I'm flying into L.A. from Boston," like I'm some sort of celebrity. But my family and I certainly aren't the first people to ever go Boston to L.A. The subject of today's episode, Dick Dale, did that as a teenager, and when he was still Richard Mansour, because his dad's job brought the family to Southern California. 40-some-odd years later, it was Dick Dale who brought today's guest, Laramie Dean, from East to West to play music with him. By that point, Dick Dale had long established himself not only as the king of surf guitar, but one of the biggest influencers on the fastest and heaviest rock music around. Laramie Dean has some new music out and more on the way, and the spirit and sound of Dick Dale is alive and well in Laramie's guitar. He took some time out a few weeks ago to talk about Dick Dale and his Deltones' third studio album, Checkered Flag, which just turned 60. What do you have coming down the pipeline?
Well, the pipeline, the current single is Pipeline.
Perfect.
This was, I know it's a podcast, but I'm holding up a picture disc. This is a picture disc of Pipeline that I did with Dick Dale's son, Jimmy, on drums. And my longtime bass player, Trevor Luca. He's currently touring with, he just did Europe with TSOL. He's been in DI for a few years. But he started off with me, both him and Jimmy, when they were 18. They just got out of high school in 2010. Mm. And we did a U.S. tour with no practice. They just got banned. So we got good chemistry. We also recorded with Jimmy Dale and Trevor Miser Lou, Dick's classic song.
Yeah.
And like you said, it's the 60th anniversary. So that the version we recorded, it came out, I think it was March of 63, Miser Lou. So it's the 60th anniversary of that, of all those songs, surf songs. Pipeline came out in 63. And we also recorded Wipeout. And that should be out in a few weeks. We're kind of on the fly here.
Yeah.
Clem Burke did the drums on that, and we're going to call it Elvis, use it as Elvis Ramone's first recording. Because Elvis Ramone never had to record with the Ramones.
Yeah, he was with them for about a week, right? And then it didn't work out so much. But he's still up there on the pantheon of punk rock and new wave as being the drummer for Blondie. So we, you know, and that's another fantastic band.
Yeah, it's awesome. He's an awesome pro. I mean, it was so great. He came in between Europe and two European tours in Coachella, and he was playing the Greek here in LA. So busy, and he came in and gave us a day in the studio, and it was just amazing. So we're so thankful for that.
So, you know, working with all these artists, and particularly Dick Dale. So we were talking before I hit record that you're in Southern California now. You're originally from the East Coast. You're from Troy, New York, a city I know pretty well. But you came to California to be with Dick Dale, right?
Oh, yeah. We had just I had met Dick earlier when I lived in New Hampshire, before the internet, at least to me. Joe Queer was like, "Hey, Dick's playing up in Portland, Maine." I'm like, "Dick Dale's still alive? You got to be kidding me." He just seems so old to me. Music, you know, that was when you're a kid. So he's like, "Yeah, we'll take the Queer's van up." I'm like, "No way, sick." So we drove up And he got us on the guest list. He had done a West Coast tour with Dick, so he became friends with the crew. And he got us in. And I first met Dick then, and I was just blown away. It's so different seeing Dick live than the recordings. It's just, he was a force of nature. His guitar tone, I mean, everything is just amazing. So that kind of blew me away. And then years later, I saw him. We had moved to Florida, and we didn't work out. We had just sold our house, and he was playing on the beach that night. The artist Wyland, he does all those. He actually in Portsmouth, they just tore down that huge wall, I guess, behind the Friendly Toast. The guy that painted that wall, he painted a wall like that in Florida, in Hollywood Beach. And we had just sold our house. I'm like, wasn't happy with what I was doing in life. So we sold the house, and I was like, oh, Dick Dale's playing on the beach. I go down, and his crew tells me, hey, Dick's looking for a guy. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. I was thinking about doing a West Coast vacation, you know? So I told my wife that night. I didn't really tell. I said, hey, I got a job with Dick Dale. I didn't really meet him for a job yet, but I'm like, she's like, you got to be kidding me. So we drove out there, and I get out there, and the guy that told me about the job's like, don't mention my name because we're in a fight right now. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. I have like, no.
Oh, that's not good. Yeah.
I have no intro to meet Dick, really. So I'm like cold calling his ranch because he is pretty accessible. His phone number was on his website at that time. And I went out there, and he hired me. So it was awesome. It's like, I did get the job.
Yeah. And then you couldn't have asked for a better mentor for what you were. Your ambitions as far as a musician goes, because he essentially created that form of music that you were playing, right?
Right, yeah. I mean, he's unquestionably the king of surf guitar, and he's got such a unique approach to the instrument. You know, he's not like a school musician, so same thing, I'm self-taught. I did end up going to school later to learn some theory, but Dick was just totally self-taught and such a unique approach to guitar.
I don't know what your feelings are about the Beach Boys. I do love the Beach Boys in all their iterations. I when we visited California this summer, my wife said, "Oh, wouldn't it be nice, huh, to see the Beach Boys live?" You know, we'd seen them a few times here in the East Coast, and she's like, "But how cool would it be to see the Beach Boys on their home turf?" I'm in California. I'm listening to California music. But when you hear Dick Dale, it's like, so you can hear Dick Dale in the Beach Boys, but you don't hear the Beach Boys in Dick Dale. I don't know what, I guess I'll just put it out there. I'm like, what are your feelings about the Beach Boys? What was Dick's feelings about the Beach Boys?
Well, I really do love the Beach Boys. I mean, you just can't argue with the power of the music. It's the vocals are awesome. I mean, you know, as a guitar player that can't sing and I wanted to have an instrumental band, that's kind of because I don't have that gift, you know. And even Dick, he's been back and forth about that in his life in different interviews. There's a lot of different source material. Dick wishes he had a voice. I mean, his big idol was Elvis, you know. Even all through his career, he loved Elvis and even the early country stuff. But he embraced his gift, his style with the guitar. And that became his signature thing. So that's kind of cool because he overcame the obstacle of not having the voice from his mouth, but from his fingers and within to project music that way. You know. So Dick, his opinion of the Beach Boys, I'll tell you, 2008, he got his cancer came back. So he's got a long history. I've been friends with him a long time. And his cancer came back in 2008. So I was on the East Coast for about a year or two when this happened, and I heard about the cancer, so I flew out to do chemo with him at Loma Linda, like driving back and forth, because at the time he was going through a divorce and there's no family at the ranch. So I said, and Jimmy was too little to drive him around. So I went out and did him the chemo treatments with him, and we did at the same time a trade show called NAMM Show. So it's the third week of January, typically every year. So he did NAMM, he did cancer treatments in the morning, and then we went to NAMM Show all the way to Anaheim. And the guy is a tank. I mean, he's so strong, you know. So we did that the first couple of days, Thursday and Friday. Saturday, Sunday is still NAMM Show. And all four nights, Dick was also getting an award, some sort of presentation from Fender Guitars. He was in a book that had just come out. And so we're staying in the Disneyland Pier Hotel, and all they play in the lobby is Beach Boys music. So every time he walked through the doors, he would wince in pain. It just cracked me up so bad. He couldn't wait to get up to his room and get out of the Beach Boys music, you know? And he always said, I used to pay them $50 to open for me. And there was a little bit of a jealousy there.
Yeah. I could see it because, you know, he seemed to stay very much like true to perfecting that style of music, where they all but abandoned that surf sound, you know, pretty early into their career. Like by the time they were making, you know, I'd say Pet Sounds, they were pretty far away from, you know, and Carl Wilson never really did that style of guitar playing that Dick was known for.
They tried, like on the first album, they did Miserable, or I forget, they did Surf. I have to go look at the records. I haven't listened to them in a while, but I mean, they would try and do some Dick Dale type songs, and it's just not the same. Obviously, it's super hard to imitate Dick Dale. A lot of people tried to back then, they couldn't capture his power.
So the way it works is we're going to apply I have a template of questions that one would use in like a museum setting or a school setting to dissect an artifact. We're going to treat Checkered Flag, the 1963 album by Dick Dale and his Deltones, the same way. And I think we've already done a pretty good job talking about his status in society, but I do want to talk just a little bit more about him as a person and his background. And I'm curious if that contributed to the material that the album is made from and his music in general is made from. So he is the founder of surf sound, but he's from the Boston, Massachusetts area. And so he came to California later on. Do you think any of that East Coast, you know, kind of grittiness of, you know, that area is embedded into the style of guitar playing that Dick Dale made famous?
I mean, if you saw early pictures of him when he came out here, he was still kind of gritty, like tough. Like there's a toughness to the East Coast, especially the Boston area where he's from. Plus growing up with immigrant parents and things too, I'm sure, you know, he had a lot of obstacles. Even back then in California, when you look at the Beach Party movie, and I'm talking later on, that's 8 years after he's been in California, he looks so different than all the California teenagers. One thing, he's like 24, 25, and he's like super dark. He's got an earring. He's just so wild to them. You know, it's such a stark contrast to everybody else, you know.
And
motorcycle, he's, you know, they were like, you know, people were just scared of him. He said when he would drive in like Newport Beach and stuff with that motorcycle, you know.
It's kind of like the Karate Kid, like when he shows up from New Jersey and, you know, everybody's like this, you know, he has dark hair. What a freak, you know, like they. And I really, you know, one of the questions that comes up with this, too, is the locations associated with it, with wherever the source is made. And, you know, and I have the perception too, like I'm an East Coast guy, as are you. When I went to California for the first time, I pictured everybody being blonde and suntanned. And
not everybody, but there's a sizable portion of the population that does kind of fit that. And they've been West Coast as long as they can, you know, their whole lives. And it goes back generations. I was talking to a guy actually in Disneyland this last month who was like, well, you know, the farthest east I've ever been is Ohio. And I was so, it was mind blowing for me because like, it's almost like, I feel like the progression of the population in this country has always been east to west, you know, kind of like opposite of the weather patterns. It's like, you know, people are always talking about back east, you know, everything back east from the west. But if you've never been to the east and if you have no roots in the east, that's how long some of these families have been in California, where it's like somebody from the east in 1960, you know, 1950s, 1960s, looks totally out of place. That says something about how Southern California had developed as a society by that time, that they see this guy as kind of like, whoa, he's like a greaser among a bunch of surfers. Like, this doesn't really, you know, kind of to go hand in hand. So I got to think that that contributed to the sound that he created, that it was like a much more raw, much more fast, because California is more known for laid back and slower pace to it versus the bustling east where everything is, you know, because I always say like the Ramones are New York. Like if you want New York, you know, encapsulated into music form, just listen to the first four Ramones albums. It's fast, it's loud, it sounds like machinery, it sounds like, you know, it's not you know, and if I want to hear California music, I think about the Beach Boys, California Girls, like, hey, man, you know, just kind of hanging out. But Dick Dale is like tearing through all those, you know, he's going up and down the 101 in his, you know, motorcycle, to use the local vernacular. So does that make sense to you?
Totally. Yeah. It makes perfect sense. Yeah.
Do you feel it? Your own music kind of has that too. Like when you, cause you've been in California for about 20 years, but do you feel like you inject some of your East Coast sensibilities into your sound?
Oh yeah, totally. I mean, when I first picked up the guitar, it was like the mid 80s, and I would go to music stores, and there was actually some astute music store clerks that said, oh, that sounds like surf guitar. And I'd never heard one lick of surf music that I was aware of. And I said, what are you talking about? You know? And it was like insulted, you know, because like New York had this like pseudo intellectual teenager feel. Like, oh, I'm from New York, I'm listening to John Zorn. Like, I'm trying to find all this obscure, you know, head music, you know, anti music in a way. But somehow it creeped into me, how I play. And so it made me search out surf music. But I still feel like the sounds that come out of me are, I still feel like I'm from Troy, New York. Like, it's still in my blood.
Like, you can't get rid of it, and nor should you try. It's like you are who you are, and it seems like that was true 60 years ago too with Dick Dale, and that he was doing that. So we, you know, when it comes to how it was made, what was Dick's way of, what was his preferred way of recording? For Checkered Flag, it looks like it was recorded all in 1 month. You know, it didn't take long for them to record the album. Did he have any preferences when it came to recording his music?
He preferred a live setting. So a lot of that for Checkered Flag at that point in Capitol, he was using a lot of the Wrecking Crew actually on the album. So he wanted to use his live guys, but Capitol said, no, you're going to use these studio musicians. So that always kind of irritated him, honestly. But at the so King of the Surf Guitar was Capitol. That was the Wrecking Crew. Same thing with this record. He got to know like Earl Palmer, the drummer, the famous jazz drummer. So like The Wedge is like one of my favorite all time Dick Dale songs. That's an original composition. And that to me shows like his peak songwriting ability for me. Just totally rips on guitar. The drums are insane. They're like mimicking Dick. Like Dick inspired the drummers to go that extra level, that the tempo. It's an amazing song, The Wedge. It's probably one of my favorites. But yeah, you can hear that's Dick's songwriting. You can tell when you listen to the whole album, this is what Capitol wants, a vocal song, right? They want a vocal song. Dick didn't feel comfortable singing. He didn't those weren't his choices. When you saw him live, it was almost all instrumental.
Right.
So, yeah, you see the album, you see the Capitol Records, producers, influence. Mm-hmm. But also his dad was a key for him, too. His dad is listed as producer on that record. So his dad helped him keep his true self, too.
That's really good. And you bring up the Wrecking Crew. For those of you listening are not really sure, it was Capitol Records, or was it just the studio's house band, basically, right? And they are probably one of the most influential group of musicians in rock and roll history, because they were the studio musicians for countless records in the 60s. That some of them and added their own little touches. I always think about the Sonny and Cher, The Beat Goes On, where the bassist, Carol King, I think is her name, or Kane,
yeah,
one of them. She was reading the music, and originally it was just, you know, a regular bass, you know, kind of walking the bass kind of thing, but she added the doom, 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 doom in between, and the beat goes on. And it's like, that song wouldn't be that song without the bass line. And right. She just injected her own musical talents and knowledge in there. And it seems like, that was working with a big company like Capitol, you know, he probably wasn't going to win an argument with them. Like, no, I want to play basically like my live band in the studio and hit record. They're like, no, you're going to get these pros. But they were such music professionals that they were listening to the artists they were working with. And they learned from them just as much as they helped record their music. And I'm sure that they carried on what they worked with Dick Dale onto other, you know, albums that they did later on in the 60s, you know, just kind of picking it up as they went.
Dick's approach, like I said, is so fast. The tempo is so fast.
Yeah.
And jazz guys can do that, but they don't hit as hard normally. You can tell, like for instance, The Wedge, like Dick is like driving that song so hard. Mm-hmm. And it's, when you look at that, the time frame that it's recorded in, it's just an incredible, it's like, to me, it's like the crown jewel of the record is that song. It's just the power and Dick's unique style, and it's pushing the musicians to catch up with Dick.
So he was putting out albums pretty one right after the other in that time mm-hmm. period, which is not that unique for the early 1960s. Mm-hmm. When you make records, it's a little bit longer process, right? Like in the modern era, because it's not as... There's a lot more production involved, in not only in the studio, but also with, you know, producing the physical record and or CD or however it's coming out. It seems to be a little more stagnated now, where like a record company will say, we want, you know, one album, and then we'll market around that for a while. Whereas it looks like in the, you know, from his previous album, there was one earlier that year, and then he had another one come September. Do you think it was just Capitol, I hate using it, but capitalizing on the popularity of that kind of music, of surf music?
Yeah, they pushed that stuff out. As you know, when Dick signed that contract, they picked up Surfer's Choice. They distributed that. They wanted to start pumping that material out. His music was pretty fickle. Like the taste changed quite a bit. So they wanted to get, I think Dick had a 4-album deal. So they wanted to get all his records out basically as soon as they could.
What do you think contributed to the fickleness of, you know, the taste in music? Was it because rock and roll was still so early on, it was changing shape all the time, that you think the teenage fans in particular were like, they get bored with it?
Yeah, I think society was like that too. Remember, you got the hula hoop. We got a new trend every month, you know. And it was different because there was like, you know, just a couple of TV stations, one or two radio stations. So all the teens did the same thing. Everybody followed suit, like whatever changed popular culture. So they're like, oh, we got to get this surfing music out, you know. So,
yeah.
And the Beach Boys had huge success with the vocal version of it. So, you know, Dick had to try and compete with that. And then obviously the Beatles came and destroyed everything.
Right. They're watching and waiting for their moment, and then they pounced and changed the face of rock and roll forever.
I got to think that the reason why, the, you know, this follow-up to, you know, the Surf album, the Surf Guitar one is Checkered Flag. It's like, well, you know, the other one came out in the spring, so everyone's getting ready for summer. And for a good part of the country, going to the beach and having a soundtrack to go to the beach, you know, it's, we can enjoy it in June, July, and August. But then when September rolls around, yeah, you guys in Southern California, you get to have an endless summer, to borrow another Beach Boys song album.
Right.
But the rest of the country is going back to getting ready for the fall and the winter and not being at the beach all the time. So, you know, I'm sure the sensibilities were, okay, let's not keep churning out songs about surfing and songs about the beach. It can be the style. But by doing so, it seems like they added another like theme for surf music. So like you have some car songs or things that are related to that too, right? And it kind of sets the tempo for driving around and cruising and stuff.
Yeah, I got my, I still have my 1950 Oldsmobile that I bought in Portsmouth, New Hampshire in 1997.
Perfect.
I'm the second owner. We drove it out here. It's not a trailer queen. It's a daily driver car, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, for, actually, I started because I felt like I missed the third wave of surf in the 90s of all my favorite surf bands. I thought I'd catch on with the hot riding thing. So that's what my theme was really in the 90s was the cars. Because, again, we're from Portsmouth and
right. It's
rooted there. And I was like going with the car theme. And yeah, when you mentioned the surfing and then the cars too, it's all those surf bands were getting a little bit older and they were making money from their surf records. So they could now buy custom cars out here where it was another big piece of the culture too from the 50s. Yeah. So then they could invest money. Oh, I'm going to buy a cool car, you know, and the Beach Boys wrote songs about it. And it, all of a sudden the theme went from surfing. Now we got hot rods. Right. And that's a novel. Like you said, it's fickle. Within a year, Dick's doing surf songs. Oh, now I need to do a hot rod album. They're within the same year, you know?
Do you think that the quality of Checkered Flag matches up with King of the Surf Guitar? Are they on the same level as far as like you were saying, the Wedge is one of your favorites, but
as a
whole album, are they on the same level as far as like, you know, this is just as quality surf music, even though it's not necessarily about surfing?
No, yeah, I think those are same. They have a couple of strong instrumentals, Capitals pushing vocal songs. Actually, you know, when you look at it, like that song, King of the Surf Guitar, they had a vocal song written for Dick to try and promote him and keep pushing him as King of the Surf Guitar. It's kind of a funny song when you think about it. I'm going to sing a song about how I'm the king.
Yeah.
So, you know, if it's Dick, if you know Dick, it fits his personality pretty well.
Yeah. That's funny. It's you kind of picture like some bands will have songs like about their band and it kind of works, you know, but other times it seems odd, you know, like Elvis never really had a song like I'm the king, you know, it's like that wouldn't really make a lot of sense, but it seems like they were in that era, you know, crowning somebody the king of surf guitar was probably, you know, because like you said, people were trend followers. They wanted to identify themselves as following only the best and, you know, keeping up with the Joneses and having their neighborhood, you know, these suburban, which I'm sure I know Southern California had a lot of suburban sprawl where, you know, houses kind of look the same as each other. And, you know, you don't want to, you're not going to boast about liking something mediocre or, you know, well, this band that kind of sounds like some, you know, I'm the best and you should listen to the best. And, you know, I'm the authority on this kind of stuff. But I think he has the catalog of music to back it up. You know, it's not like anybody's going to. Now, a lot of people, and myself included, were first exposed to Dick Dale by way of Pulp Fiction, with Miserlou being included as not only in the soundtrack, but like the main song over the opening credits. So a lot of, I think, kind of retrospect with that kind of music, attaching it, and there, like you said, there was a revival of surf music in the 90s. Once again, strangely, out of places like Toronto had some surf bands and stuff like that. So it wasn't necessarily you had to see the Pacific Ocean in order to be a surf musician. It was the style was established in the 60s, and then just kind of picked up from that point on.
So the intended audience, I think we've touched on this a little bit, but and as a musician yourself, maybe you can speak to this. When you are writing and then recording music, you know, obviously, like when you're playing live, that's your audience. That's who you're playing to. But when you're recording and you're making your music for an album, who do you usually have on your mind that this is for? Like, who do you want listening to it? Obviously, everybody, but is there a particular group of people that you tend to have on the forefront of your mind?
Really, I just write what I enjoy playing, what I've loved over the years, what I suck in, you know, like my entertainment. Like, I love old comedies, I like old science fiction, things like that. The surf movies, you know, those are inspiring to me still. I like the funniness of them, I guess. You know, I think about, I mean, most of my life, I haven't put out a lot of music. I mostly have just done a live show. I got into playing live in New Hampshire, and same thing when I moved to Florida. And then when I came out to live with Dick, I wanted to learn how to tour. Like, I've been up and down the East Coast a few times, but when I'm writing now, it's different because the pandemic really changed my mindset from being just a live show and having a few original songs to now I want to put music out. So I've been, it's funny that you mentioned that the process, like I have a producer. He hired Dick to do the music for Space Mountain. His name is Eddie Sato. So he worked at Disney as an Imagineer for 10 plus years, and he still freelances. He's just an awesome artist. He did the artwork for Pipeline, for Gidget's Brain, that came out 2 years ago during the pandemic. So he's helped me more to focus on the theme of the song and, like you said, the audience. So we're looking for, you know, we're just looking to make the best music that we can, and hopefully people like it and buy it and support it. And right now, like the two songs that we're focused on, the three songs are other people's songs, you know, like Miserloo and Pipeline and Wipeout. But it's because of that we're paying tribute to the history of these songs, of this genre, because I feel like it's an overlooked genre because people just think it's, they don't take it seriously. And Dick took his music very seriously. Like, I think Dick in particular, the way he played guitar was a very serious animal. He used that his equipment, his tone. Like, people have always described him, and I'm not the only one. Everyone always says, like, a force of nature. Like, seeing Dick live was surf guitar because it was, like, so powerful. Like, you just felt it vibrate, you know?
I got to think that is – I guess when we put it all together and then take it back apart again, it's like the audience – for your music, and I know there's other groups that, like, I don't know if you've heard of the Surfer Jets. They're out of Canada, and they not only play the music, but they have, like, the full 60s get up with the, you know, the tall boots and the short skirts and everything. And, you know, the beehive hairdos and all that. It's like you're kind of like putting it out there, like you said, like, serious. Like, this is not just music that's in the background in a goofy movie or, you know, in a commercial for something to do with California. It's like, it's good music. It takes a lot of talent to do it. We're looking for people that have that appreciation. You know, it's like music lovers will love this music. If you're casual, not really into pop music or anything, or you don't like oldies or anything, then it's probably not for you. You know, like, if you enjoy it, fantastic. But this is more for the, not quite music snob, but just like the music aficionado, somebody who, like, really cares about. And that's what I've always gone back to that with the punk scene too. It's like, you know, people write off a lot of punk music as being, you know, because it's, you know, usually kind of crude, not vocally necessarily, but just like, and it's raw. It doesn't have, you know, the overproduced sound to it. But when you break it down to its essentials, it's the fun side of rock and roll that's been brought back. You know, as I love Green Day. Like, they pulled us out of that grunge, you know,
pit that we were in, just like, and there was like, oh, here's an upbeat drums, beat once again. And like, even if their songs weren't happy, it was like they had energy to them. It's like they woke you up a little bit. It was like drinking coffee or something. Where, and so I feel like that it's like that audience will always kind of be hovering around. And I'll put myself in that audience when I hear something, like when I saw you at, playing opening for the Queers a couple years ago. I'm like, that is music that I like. You know, that's like it hits all the like a quick checklist comes up. I'm like, is it authentic? Does it have like parts of the past in it? Do they have, is it fun? Is it danceable? Check, check, check. Okay, I like it. It's I'm down with it. And it's not goofy. It's not trying to be, like a parody or something like that. Because I'm not big on that. It's authentic. Neither, it's real. Yeah. And that's what Dick was all about too, right? Like he was probably a most genuine musician you could find.
Absolutely, yeah. He kept the same equipment from the 60s. I mean, the serial number, one of his heads was 00048. So his story was, I built the first 47 Showman amplifiers, so he got the 48th one right. I'm like, it's so amazing that he still has that head. And like every time I'd be picking it up, I'm like, I cannot believe. I'm like, I used to keep his guitar when I lived on his ranch. My wife and I, he got us a trailer to live in that because he didn't want our cats in his house. I'm like, this is a guy that had like lions, right? I don't know if you know how much about this history, but he actually had like at one time 40 different cats. His Balboa mansion at the
That kind of fits perfectly, actually.
He had like 9 lions in that mansion alone. So when I moved, he invited us to live there. We were going to stay in the guest room, and he's like, "You brought cats? We can't have cats in here. The dogs will get upset." I'm like, "Oh, brother." So then he got us a trailer to live on the ranch. But I used to keep his guitar with me in the trailer. I'm like, I got to hold the beast every day for like a year, just living on the ranch. It's just an awesome presenter. When he hit the stage, I just love that about him.
That goes so far, especially in a time period that we're discussing here with the early 1960s, when pop music was still trying to find its way. People were trying to, and rock and roll in particular, was really trying to find, I don't know if you remember from school, if you ever had a history class that had the huge timeline. It was like the world history timeline across like the wall. I have one of my own, and it probably came from like the 40s or the 50s. I have one in my own classroom, and it starts, it's like all of human history, and it's a big like hand-drawn timeline, and it's like from the earliest days, it's just like one big line, and it looks like a giant snake, but then by the time you get, as time goes on, it branches off into all these different directions, and then by the time you're in the modern era, it's like so many different like tentacles going in every direction. Right. And, rock and roll has turned that way for sure. Like I was just earlier today recording an episode about an album from 10 years later, Piano Man by Billy Joel. Mm-hmm. And it's like, by that point, rock and roll had really graduated. There was lots of different variations of it and different sounds and other forms of music and, showing up in there. But in 1963, it's still pretty, it's not quite as diced up. There's maybe like 4 or 5 different genres, and it looks like, and Dick Dale and other surf, they're carving out surf guitar and surf music as another subgenre of rock and roll. He's also given credit, and I don't know how much you feel about this strongly, of being the father of heavy metal, that some people call him that. Do you give that credibility, that reference of heavy metal guitar being started with Dick Dale?
Oh, totally. That style of picking, when you listen to the way he plays guitar, and then you graduate, like you said, to the Jimi Hendrix era with the distorted guitar, you can see that mixing those two, graduating. I think of that on the, especially on the West Coast heavy metal scene. I think of all the metal bands and the way their speed picking and developed was totally from Dick Dale. Dick Dale brought that speed picking in, and then they just brought in the saturation and distortion on the guitar amps, you know?
Yeah, and you got yourself, it's like you see, it's kind of like how Motorhead is one of those bands that people from various different, if you're into punk rock, if you're into heavy metal, if you're into thrash, if you're into, everybody gravitates back towards Motorhead. They're like, yeah, we all love them. It seems like that Dick Dale kind of has that same status among other kinds of music too, that they're like, yeah, this guy's, because back in 1963, even if he did do that with his guitar, like amp, distort it and have, fire from the stage and, somebody, it would get him arrested pretty quickly, probably. But 20 years later, it's the norm, So it's like, it's just fun to see somebody from that era being given credit for, music that became, so fixed to a different time period, because it seems so innocent by comparison, when it comes to that.
So right behind King Diamond every night, and every night the sound guy was like, man, you guys are louder than King Diamond.
Yeah.
It would be so funny to me. I mean, every night, I'm like, I know.
But that's... So,
what did you say? I can't hear you. What? My wife's like, we've got to get earplugs.
But I think that could only come from like the perfect like mashup that we were talking about. Like, maybe if Dick Dale had grown up his entire life in Southern California, it wouldn't have come out that way. But because he had that upbringing that he did and where he lived, and what was it that brought him out west? Was it the same dream everybody else has and that wants to break out in show business of Hollywood's the place to go, Southern California's where you got to go to make it, or was there another reason that he went?
He was a machinist, and he worked for Hughes Aircraft, so they came out when Dick was a senior. And actually, his dad was really the one that pushed him in that. Dick didn't have that show business bug, but his dad really pushed him into it. So having his dad really saved him from a lot of mistakes that all the other young musicians had, because his dad was a they control the masters. So even when they were at Capitol, for instance, Dick retained control of all of his music. So when he left Capitol, his dad actually kept in the paperwork, kept an office at Capitol Tower Records through the 70s. So even when Dick was gone, he had his own office at Capitol still. Like, his dad was really into the music business side of things. So he saved Dick a lot of headache and worry later, because his whole catalog, Dick remained in control of his catalog. So like when Misery Lou happened, Dick made money again.
That's, I guess, in another layer of this, it really makes this and all of his music, for that matter, even more documents of the era, because, after World War II in particular, but even before World War II for that matter, but definitely after the Second World War with the Cold War, all the aeronautics and all of the airplane and high tech industries moving to California, where they had all the space for doing testing and they could, all that stuff transplanted a lot of families across the country. Most people think of Hollywood as being the big draw, but that's really hard to break into. And, there's plenty of other industries that thrive in that part of the country. And on the Pacific Coast, where it's like that only happens because of the role that the United States had moved into after World War II as the global, we have two coasts. We are a global superpower. We need to, defend our allies overseas. We need the arsenal. We can't just do what we've always done and like make our military size and ammunition drop, you know, or even civilian aircraft for that matter. You know, we can't, you know, we're moving, we're getting bigger, and, you know, that is going to make people look for jobs all over the country, depending on what they're doing. And as a result, you have Dick Dale show up from, you know, Boston area, Massachusetts to LA. And, you know, it's like a precursor to when, you know, all those punk bands from Boston and LA converged, you know, those hardcore bands in the early 80s, right. You know, it's a similar kind of thing. Cause you know, that's the societies that kind of, and their cultures that clash and result in some, in this case, some really fine sounding music. I guess to segue back to the Checkered Flag sure. album by Dick Dale, though, I'm wondering what was the reception for this album like nationally? Did you ever get, or from him, you know, when you toured with him and stuff, was he received the same way all over the country, or was it like more pockets of fandom?
Those records did not catch on, so Capitol kind of wanted to get rid of that contract. So, yeah, like you said, things are fickle, changing quickly. So he was going through those, he was putting the records out, but they weren't doing well. He just was a California. Actually, I got this book here, The History of Surf Music, like the discography. Nice. This is the stuff I grew up on, like before the internet. So actually I got these when I lived in New Hampshire. This is the book Surf and Guitars. It's an awesome book. It went through all the history of every surf band from California, which most of them nobody's ever heard of. And then it's got like this one that's got like all the like the Gold Mine and Capitol Records promo material and charts for like Dick's promotion for the Capitol Record era.
Oh, but those are great.
It didn't do well commercially for them. So they kind of wanted to get through it and move on to the next phase because the Beatles happened, what was it, February of 64? So
this record is around there, when they came across the ocean.
They were already building, but by the time they hit Ed Sullivan in February of 64, like everybody, the Ramones, everybody mentions that performance is life-changing on TV. So Dick's career with Capitol was short-lived. They just wanted to get – they were kind of – they actually, I think the last record was a live record all those Capitol records, people generally were disappointed in at the time.
Mm-hmm. And then he didn't put out another, he did a couple albums after Checkered Flag, but then it wasn't until, and then, you know, Summer Surf 64, and then it's almost 30 years.
Right.
Before the next.
There's footage of Dick's dad, Jim, crying because of the Beatles, because they crushed they crushed the California sound. The only one that survived really was some surf bands like the Crossfires became the Turtles. They're like, oh, we got to catch on to this and they could sing, you know? So they had hits, but for the most part, the California surf bands were all gone at that point. They tried to imitate the Beatles, but they couldn't do it. Even the Safaris, like they had a big hit, but that was it.
Dale, where it's like, you know, here is a pioneer, here's somebody who did something totally different from everybody around him, having all, you know, kind of like arriving at that place from his life story up until that point, and then it just going off in all these directions afterwards. So the 1993 album that he did, I have to feel like is partly because of Pulp Fiction.
Oh, yeah.
That Quentin Tarantino bringing Dick Dale music back to, you know, everybody by way of including Miser Lewin. That's, like I said before, like, I remember my brother bought the Pulp Fiction soundtrack, and then after buying, because of that tradition I was telling you about before, of my fan, you know, my brother and I like learning about bands through liner notes and stuff, mm-hmm. he bought a Dick Dale Greatest Hits CD right after that. And we would listen, you know, he would listen to that in his room, and I would listen, you know, I would borrow it sometimes too, and being like, wow, this music is.
It was CDs available. The GMP Crescendo, and then there was the Rhino one. The Rhino one. I mean, I like them both now, but the Rhino one.
I think it was the Rhino one because it had. I'm going to look at, see if I can find a picture real quick and see if I recognize it.
With the surfboard.
Yeah, like, yeah, yeah. And he's like kind of standing up a little bit.
Yeah.
That must be it.
That was the last Rhino record I bought when Rhino Records opened in Albany, New York, which was so weird when I think about it. Because
of
all
the places.
I'm like growing up on Music Shack in Troy, World's Records in Central and Albany, you know, and then Rhino Records opens. And I finally get to hear what surf music is for real after like years of hearing about it.
Right.
And they have all the surf music reissues, you know? So I bought Ventures, I bought Link Ray, and I'm like, all right, I'll buy Dick Dale because this cover looks terrible.
Yeah.
Yeah, that one.
Yeah, that's the one, yeah.
And I'm like, this record rips. The guitar is amazing.
Yeah.
Like, I love the Ventures on Link Ray, but Dick's just spoke to me right away. Just the speed. I mean, the pure power, the way he played it.
Yeah.
That record.
I mean, awesome. You wouldn't get that from that album cover. And honestly, you wouldn't get that from the Checkered Flag album cover either. Like, it's just like his, you know, because in those days they wanted to present a certain image on the cover, and they, you know, it was like all so thematic. Like, well, it's a record about racing cars, so we got to have a guy with oil stains on his face and, you know, looking all, and instead of like actually, you know, being like letting the, like, there was no like graphic design back then for albums. It wasn't like as clever.
Dick just hops into like those records, like on the descriptions on the back, like his pool playing, his archery. I think the next record, Mr. Eliminator. And like, he really loved archery. He had like a fascination with certain subjects, you know, playing pool. He had Frank Sinatra's pool table at his house. He loved, and he had all these really expensive pool cues. I remember leaning back in the Lazy Boy and I knocked over a bunch of pool cues behind me. He's like,
oh God,
for like $10,000 each. I'm like, why are they in the living room?
How would I know that?
Even with the Capitol Records input, Dick always maintained part of his personality because he was such a strong personality. If you ever met him or you see him in interviews, he was really unflinching with his view, you know?
Did he actually surf a lot, or even like, was he into hot rods too, or was it?
Oh yeah. So he loved surfing. I mean, again, he got into it after he moved here when he was in high school. It was really after high school that he got like, moved to Newport Beach, and he loved Newport Beach and Lido. And when I was living with him, he had a boat, a yacht down there, you'd call it. And, it was just awesome. That was the only time that me and Dick were ever really alone, because it would just be me and him going down to the boat for a week at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And he would relive those memories of surfing. He brought me to his old house at the Wedge in Balboa on the point there, the Gillette Mansion. That's the only time I ever saw him cry, because he just loved that mansion. He just hated getting this. His first wife, the divorce was, he lost everything. You know, that's why he went and started working again, because he was retired, you know.
Mm-hmm. And he chose a good time to come back, because his style of music was definitely returning in that era. And I think a lot, like what we've already talked about, is as far as like, you know, because the early 90s is when the kids of his original audience were old enough to start playing their own music, and what choice do we have but to go to what we've grown up listening to and start making more of that? Like, I remember the band I was in high school, the first song I ever wrote for the group was called Cruising the Loop. And it was like, it was a basically based on American Graffiti. Like, I watched that movie. I loved it. Still love it. And was like, I basically wrote a song about, and it kind of had surfy type sound to it, but it was like very much just about, you know, being, you know, car culture and stuff like that. You know, in reality, I was driving around in a minivan around Plattsburgh, New York, you know, going to get IHOP pancakes and stuff. So it was very much like a fantasy, you know, putting myself in the early 60s kind of thing. Sure. But it was still like, that was, you know, it could have only come from the way that pop culture was coming back to us with that kind of imagery and that sound and that, you know, romanticizing of Southern California style, you know, cruising around. And yeah, you have like a month in the Northeast to do that, by the way, everybody. You can't really, it's like August, you know.
It's happening. It's almost over.
Right. Labor Day ends it, and then you go back to getting ready for winter. And something that I'm sure Dick Dale and his family didn't mind getting away from when they moved to Southern California. I could definitely see the appeal, and yourself as well. Laramie, it's been such a fun time talking to you about this record, and I look forward to hearing your music as it comes out. And where can people best find you on the internet or elsewhere?
Well, obviously a lot of people use streaming, so I'm on Spotify. I try and keep that updated. I have my own website, laramiedean.com. I'm on Instagram, Facebook, so I'm pretty accessible. I check everything every day.
And I can attest to that, because that's how we got in touch with each other.
Yeah, it's I'm easy to reach. Yeah,
and so all the Instagram and Facebook is just look up at Laramie Dean, you'll find it there. Right? So we'll do that. Well, I appreciate you coming on the show, and thanks for joining the EPS podcast, where everything, including Dick Dale and his Deltones Checkered Flag, the 1963 album, is a primary source. We'll talk to you next time. I feel like October of 1963 is the high watermark of the age of optimism and promise for the United States that followed World War II. Within 2 months, John F. Kennedy, the young president who embodied the hope for the 1960s, would be killed. American involvement in Vietnam would escalate soon afterwards, and that war would transform society and culture for years to come. On the pop culture front, Southern California would soon be overshadowed by visitors from even further east than Boston. SoCal had represented the upbeat, sunny feel of the decade, and given the country its movies, TV shows, Disneyland, and soundtrack, courtesy of the Beach Boys and Dick Dale. All of these products of California would lose their spotlight thanks to the Beatles and the subsequent British invasion. Checkered Flag, therefore, is an indispensable last hurrah of an era. Check out the Everything is a Primary Source podcast online by going to everything-history.com. There you'll find links to the show's social media as well as the other offerings besides the podcast. Be sure to like, rate, and share the show wherever you're listening to it now. Only your support can grow the show. Also, be sure to check out surf guitarist Laramie Dean wherever you get your tunes, and visit him at laramiedean.com. I'll talk to you next time on the EPS podcast, where everything is a primary source.